call the this session of the Government Accountability and Information Technology Committee to order. This morning we're going to have a discussion about our Constitution and the potential for having a constitutional convention. This state has not had a constitutional convention since the original constitutional convention in 1857 when it started. I believe that, you know, the over 300 amendments that we've made to the Constitution make it imperative that we do something to, you know, bring our Constitution back to the intent of most constitutions, which is overarching policy instead of statute, which our Constitution has turned out to be in large part. I have a lot of very important speakers this morning, and I'm going to go through those folks that are on the agenda, and after that, if there's time, I'll take anyone who has signed up to speak or wishes to speak. But right now, I'm not going to take these in the exact order that they're here. I'm going to ask Attorney General Hardy Meyer if you would come up first. Thank you for being with us this morning, and I appreciate you coming to give us your remarks on this subject.
Thank you, Chair Riley, members. For the record, Hardy Myers, Attorney General. Pleased to have the opportunity to join you today. Judge Lindy, I think, is going to have somewhat more extended remarks, but I will give you in brief my own thinking about this issue of climate stated as an issue of whether to undertake a new study of the Oregon Constitution. And I think that there are really two overarching questions. One, whether to undertake such a review, and secondly, how best to do it. From the perspective of a government lawyer, I think probably a primary case for urging a fresh look at the Oregon Constitution would probably center on various ambiguities and uncertainties about the meaning of different provisions that have been the cause of, you know, repeated litigation and expense for the state. There's that level of case to be made. But in a more fundamental political way, Chair Riley and members, I think the case for a fresh revisit to the Oregon Constitution really rests on the fact that the questions about its quality as a political charter of government are really those major questions that engage the attention of the constitutional revision process 40-some years ago, and which produced a proposed revised constitution, which the Legislative Assembly came within a vote of referring to the people. Those major questions of the basic quality of the document as a political charter really are much unchanged from 40-some years ago. For example, the question of the extent to which the executive authority of the state should be centered in the governor. The question of how the post-audit function of the government should be organized and conducted. As for the legislature, the question of whether the legislature should meet in annual session. The question whether the redistricting, reapportionment procedures and provisions of the Constitution need some further change. As to the judiciary, the question of how judges should be selected. Whether the Supreme Court should have rulemaking authority. Interestingly, I might say that one of the main concerns of the revision process 40-some years ago, a unified state court system, that has been achieved by the legislature. And I was very proud to have a role in that during my own period of legislative service. But these other issues around the judiciary still exist. The question of government finance, the initiative and referendum, provisions of the Constitution. And then, of course, the fact, as you alluded to a moment ago, Chair Riley, the fact that the Constitution is replete with what really are ordinary law provisions that appropriately really should be statutory material. And that was a specific undertaking of the prior revision process, which was to identify what those provisions were and to propose as part of the new Constitution itself that they be transferred to statute. So I think on a couple of levels, at least, there is a very good case to be made for undertaking a study of the Oregon Constitution with the potential outcome of a revised Constitution for the people to consider. The question of how to best do that is another issue. I personally think that let's be mindful of the fact that in 1960, before the last revision process got underway, the people of Oregon amended the Oregon Constitution so as to authorize the Legislative Assembly itself to refer a comprehensively revised Constitution. Whereas before, the only process really available to get to such an end was to propose a constitutional convention and have the people vote on that, whether to have a convention. And prior to that amendment in 1960, any amendments to the Oregon Constitution had to be submitted piecemeal to the people, one by one, as opposed to a comprehensive document. So that 1960 gateway amendment authorizing the Assembly to refer a revised document, as opposed to individual amendments, was indeed the gateway to the revision process which the 1961 session put into place by the adoption of a joint resolution that led to the formation of the commission which drafted the Constitution and submitted it to the 63 session of the Assembly. I respectfully think, Mr. Chair, that given the fact that we have in place a statewide representative body with a committee structure, with staff, with those resources in place, that the model established 40 years ago, that is to say a commission which proposes to the Assembly for referral to the people, that model is a very, very sound one. And it has the advantages of avoiding the cost of any election, dealing with whether to call a convention. It avoids the cost of the convention itself. And I think, too, if an election is held for the purpose of being elected to a constitution convention, you, I think, have a much greater risk compared with, say, a commission of a number of people who are going to run and be elected with some very, very, very specific and perhaps very narrow agenda, personal agenda that they would bring into that dynamic, as opposed to a willingness to really consider a comprehensive look at the Constitution. It's a political issue, of course, not a legal issue as to whether the convention is ultimately part of the process or not. I'm simply sharing very respectfully my own thoughts about how that part might be handled in light of the experience of 40 years ago and the people's approval in 1960 of a constitutional amendment authorizing the Assembly to be the source of a referral of a revised document. Those then, Mr. Chair, members, are my basic thoughts about the issue that you're undertaking to consider now. And again, I appreciate the chance to offer a few thoughts about it.
Thank you very much. Any questions? Yes, Representative Thatcher.
Yes, thank you. I think it might be helpful, I know it would be for me, if you could explain what a convention, how that would actually be. I'm not sure what we're comparing. A commission, I can understand. What would be the process of having a convention?
The constitutional provisions addressing a convention are very, very limited. Here's what the Constitution says. This is Article 17, Section 1. That article deals with amendments and revisions of the Constitution. And Section 1 provides in part, no convention shall be called to amend or propose amendments to this Constitution or to propose a new Constitution unless the law providing for such convention shall first be approved by the people on a referendum vote at a regular general election. So the detail of the convention, the size, the selection of its delegates, staffing, all of those kinds of sort of instrumental details are left entirely to the legislature, as I would interpret this provision, to provide. And the one requirement is, however, that the law providing for the convention has to be submitted to the people for approval. So it's a very spare provision.
Yes.
And then, if I might, just add quickly.
Absolutely.
The amendment I referred to in 1960, which authorized the Assembly to refer a revised Constitution, it simply provides that in addition to the power to amend this Constitution granted by, and then it refers back to an earlier section, and that's the amendment by amendment process of referral, a revision of all or part of this Constitution may be proposed in either house of the Legislative Assembly, and if the proposed revision is agreed to by at least two-thirds of all the members of each house, the proposed revision shall referred by the Secretary of State to the people for their approval or rejection. So that was the gateway amendment that I was discussing earlier, just to your powers.
Representative Byer.
Thank you. This is not very familiar territory for me, so
it's not for any of us.
All the details that you talk about, who would serve, that would go with this. Do those also have to be in the referral, or is it just a referral to have one?
Well, that's an interesting question. I think that's not 100% clear. It says that unless the law providing for such convention shall first be approved, I think probably the prudent course, which is, I think, the course that was proposed by Senate Bill 920 last session, would be to refer to the people the entire act, which included the detail of the convention, as distinct from just the fact that there would be a convention convened.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Chair.
I'm going to get on the phone Commissioner Avakian, who wanted to testify on this, and let him testify next.
Representative Richardson, you're going to cut out for just a minute, but we'll bring you back in. You still there, Representative Richardson?
Oh. Yes, I'm still here.
Okay.
But he has it on mute, so.
That's the clanking of the computer keys.
Yeah, right.
Mr. Perez.
Hi, Commissioner Bakken. It's Dana Richardson calling from the House hearing.
How you doing, Dana?
Good. We'll get you. I'm going to get one of the person on the phone, and then we'll receive your testimony.
Okay.
Representative Richardson, you still there? Representative Richardson?
Bakken is on.
Just that. Okay. Do I press it twice? Representative Richardson, are you there?
Nope, still Brad Avakian.
Well, that's good. We still have you. Getting technical assistance. Just a sec.
That's all right.
I go ahead and call.
Oh, and call Representative Richardson back? Oh.
Thank you.
This is Dennis Richardson. This is June. May I help you?
Hi, June. It's Dana Richardson calling from the House hearing. I think we cut Representative Richardson off. Can you put us back through?
Sure. Just a second.
Thanks. Okay, I'm going to let you do it.
Hello, it's Dennis again.
Hi.
Lost you.
Sorry.
Okay, they should both be on.
Commissioner Bakken, are you there?
Bakken's here.
Representative Richardson, are you there?
Yes, I'm here.
Terrific.
Very good. All right. Success. Commissioner Bakken, this is Representative Riley. We had testimony from the Attorney General earlier, and we want to take your testimony at this time. Could everyone hear that? Okay. So if you could just go right ahead, Brad, and we will take your testimony.
Well, I will, Mr. Chair, and thank you for inviting me to testify this morning on the issue. What I'll do, though, is I'll try and keep my testimony relatively short and see if the committee has any questions, because it's certainly a topic we could spend a great deal of time on if the chair chose to. But I understand that the committee is taking a look at the bill that I had last session and was contemplating the session before, and whether or not Oregon should hold a new constitutional convention. And the concept comes from really the established principle that constitutions exist for particular purposes, to define and limit the role of government and to secure and protect the natural rights of individuals. And in at least my reading of our state constitution, even if it originated under those principles, has become something much, much different. And seems appropriate that here in the 21st century, we have a new constitutional convention to not just review whether or not the original constitution with all of its amendments now fulfilled those principles, but whether or not there are additional things that maybe today's society would want included. Now, there's, I suppose, more ministerial reasons for doing it, too. If you read our Constitution carefully, there are misspelled words throughout. We even misspelled the word religion, and I think it was in Article 2, we even misspelled the word Constitution. And there's other unusual things, such as in Article 1, we have two Section 36s, because two initiatives in 1914 were both being Section 36, and so they entered the Constitution that way. And so there are things that just need cleaning up. I'd also suggest that there are entire sections that I think really probably don't fit the reasons for having a constitution, and I'll give just a couple examples. For instance, in Article 1, Section 41, we have a section on the work and the training of inmates in our correctional facilities. It's probably a very good thing to have, maybe more appropriate for statute than constitution. The section goes through the intake process for inmates and how they're going to be compensated, how we're going to market their services, even how the accounting for money will take place that's generated from inmate work. Again, probably very good things to have in law, maybe not necessary if we're defining the powers of government or ensuring the rights of individuals. We also have areas of the Constitution that have constantly generated either litigation or legislative discussion. Things like, what do the words uniform and general mean when we talk about a system of common schools? What does the term emergency mean when we're talking about sessions of the legislature? Things that have never been fully resolved for us. Other examples of things that probably don't rise to the level of constitutional principle, I believe it's Article 9, we have a section that discusses state stationery. When the state of Oregon wants to buy stationery, we deemed, I guess, it was constitutionally necessary that we discuss how when we buy stationery, we look to the lowest bidder. again, an important concept, maybe one that doesn't rise to constitutional level. And then the last two things that I'll mention, we also have numerous sections dealing with taxation. Taxation, of course, a very important piece to have mentioned in the Constitution somewhere, since we're talking about the need to limit the powers of government and protect the rights of individuals. But if you take, as an example, the section on property taxes, which is section 11, Article 11, we go through in great detail how to define the limits of assessed values. We, I think, have over 20 sections and many, many more subsections, giving very specific definitions. And these are things that historically would be the powers of government would be outlined, but the very specifics on how to implement would be statutory. We then even go through 10 different sections on the creation and the repealing of different sections on property taxes that probably no longer need to clutter our Constitution. And then again, if you look to Article 11, many, many sections dealing with things like rural credits, farm and home loans, irrigation payments, World War Veteran Sinking Fund, pollution control credits, and on and on and on. Many things that are very, very important may be more appropriate for statute. I think there's even a section that establishes the Food Care Commission. The Home Care Commission, which ensures care to elderly and the disabled, again, an extremely important function of government, but we don't include any of the other many, many state commissions the legislature has created in the Constitution, just this one. So, Mr. Chair, you know, for those reasons, I think it's very appropriate to have the new 21st century discussion on the purpose of our Constitution and at the same time take advantage to do a little house cleaning and clean the thing up.
Thank you, Commissioner. There are a couple of questions. I have one question first. Attorney General Meyer actually suggested that he believes we're probably better off having a commission as is authorized by the Constitution since 1960, when it was changed to authorize the legislature to propose a changed Constitution. What's your feeling on that?
Do you mean, Mr. Chair, a commission to look at the need for doing this and maybe setting up a process?
No, I actually mean very much like the 1961 commission, which actually created a new constitutional document to present to the legislature, and that is opposed to the legislature actually proposing a convention and setting up the rules to do that.
Right. No, I understand. A great deal of respect for the Attorney General and anything that that office would lend to the process here. I suppose I come from a little bit different perspective, and that's the constitutions need to be created by the people. And even though we have a republic form of government that elects people to legislators to represent the people, and the powers exist in order to do it that way, I do believe, even though it would be very politically difficult to do, that if a new constitution is to be drawn, that it needs to be drawn from the people and not by anybody elected as a representative of the people.
Thank you. Representative Greenlick is with us today, and he has a question for you.
Good morning, Brad.
Good morning.
As you know, I support this process, and I was a co-sponsor with you of Senate Bill 920. What's going to be on the floor, I suspect, in a bit, is a whole set of concerns about the bad things that can happen in a constitutional convention. Many of us could go through the Constitution and mark those things that we think should absolutely stay, and those things you should absolutely get rid of, and I suspect if we did that, they wouldn't all be the same sections. What do you say to the people who are concerned that a constitutional convention will do damage to some basic rights that are very much important to one of us or the other of us in the body?
Well, we're always, Mr. Chair and Representative Greenlick, as legislators, I think you're all, and when I was one of you, are always in the position of taking action that offends one or another. But I guess I have great trust in Oregonians to make the kind of decisions that will benefit them in Oregon. And if each of us are able to go through the current Constitution and all come up with a healthy list of things that we think are not right, then that alone tells me that some action needs to be taken. And I would always fall back to the principle that if that kind of action needs to be taken, that it's up for the people to decide. And if the people decide things that offend one or the other, that's part of the process of building and managing governments. And if you'll notice, the bill that I had presented, I tried to address that in one way. Representative Greenlick and I wanted to ensure that you didn't have that you had not only the people at the Constitutional Convention deliberating, but that there was also a commission that had no authority, but that existed in order to advise the delegates at the convention to be a resource. That commission had representatives appointed from the legislature, from the governor, and from the Supreme Court. These would be experts on Oregon history, on constitutional principles of law, and that would exist in order to help the delegates in the formation of the new constitution. And that, I think, is one safeguard to what you bring up, Representative Greenlick.
Thank you very much, Commissioner.
Any further questions? Don't seem to be any further questions, Commissioner. Do you want to stay on the line and listen, or should we go on?
I think you should go on, but Mr. Chair, thanks for taking up the issue.
Thank you very much. Okay, I'm going to ask Justice Hans Lunde if you would come up and give us your remarks.
Good morning.
Good morning.
I'm Hans Lunde. I teach state constitutional law across the street at the Willamette University. Very pleased that this committee is considering how best to reform the Oregon Constitution, and I hope I can answer any questions that you may have. I want to first reaffirm and emphasize the points that Attorney General Myers has already made. And others have made before, aside from him, and that is that there's no question that the present Constitution needs reform. And it's become much else than a Constitution. And interesting, I think the 150th anniversary is an appropriate time to restore the Constitution to its original functions. And which is exactly what It happened 50 years ago on the anniversary, on the centennial, when the Governor Hatfield and the legislature at that point submitted to the people the proposal that now is the law that allows a commission, or doesn't mention a commission, allows the legislature by 2/3 votes to submit a revision to the... Now, they made that decision for a purpose. As a matter, I should add here, at the invitation to testify today reminded me that I've been involved with this subject for just exactly 1/3 of the whole history of the state, since statehood. And so this is an old familiar topic for me. I've submitted this testimony in writing, so you can look it up, but I'm going to skip the portion of the history that Hardy Myers has already covered, and how we came to have this alternative way of doing the job. Well, there's no question that the ultimate authority for having a change is for the voters, for the, as we like to say, the people, although only a minority of people vote. It's for the voters. The people who amended this constitution back 50 years ago to allow the commission process certainly didn't deny that, and they were aware of that. And the only question is the preparation of such a document better left to delegates who are elected from around the state for that purpose, or can the elected representatives of the people speak for the people in this respect? And the idea that, quote, people, unquote, conduct a convention in a town meeting format, of course, is imaginary. It's a fiction. That's not going to happen. We're not going to have grassroots assembly, champui, getting together to decide we better have some laws. So let's get together and make some laws. So I really think the question is a very practical one. Now, the discussion today is, I gather, is mainly about the question whether to have a convention or whether to have a commission, and I'll come back to that at the end of what I want to say. But I should tell you a little bit more about what happened 50 years ago, how we went about doing this when I was on that commission as a young professor teaching constitutional law. I was appointed by the speaker because I had some experience with the Congress and elsewhere, and was teaching at the University of Oregon at the time. And the people who were on that commission included senators and representatives, senior members of the legislature, and three judges and two ex-governors, as well as public members. I was one of the public members. And we knew something about what a constitution is supposed to be about, and what it does, and how it functions, and what has no business being in a constitution. The concern about a convention, and there have been many around the country, is not just not that they'll take out whites. I mean, it's hard to prevent isn't the right word, but to object and to create veto groups against taking things out. The concern is that a convention is going to be made up of people who want to deal with the world of that moment as they see it. It's going to be a bunch of snapshots as to what goes in, because it concerns people at that time. And no need to be in the Constitution, but that's what people are concerned about. For most people, the question of individual rights and the property rights or free speech or religion or gay marriage or medical marijuana or whatever happens to be the hot issue of the time, it's much more interesting, much more important, and particularly taxation, no question about that, but much more exciting, and that's what they think they want to vote on. It's not the structure of government. And what this government needs is what we thought then, 50 years ago, at least I don't think anything has made it less necessary than it was then, a reconsideration of how to create a functional government that does job. I'm not saying that the model of 50 years ago necessarily was the one you wanted to adopt today. And other things, and we can talk about that if you want to, but in a sense, that is the next step. That isn't before us today. Before us is the question, how do you get a body together that will prepare something that is a coherent, intelligent design for the state's government? It's not about a Bill of Rights. Now, what we did 50 years ago, we got together, you know, the judges there, O'Connell and Ted Goodwin, who's on the Ninth, still in the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals, federal judge, and so on. And one thing the legislators and the judges, nobody agreed upon, is we wouldn't be able to move forward unless we took the old traditional 1859 Bill of Rights off the table. We weren't going to do that. We're going to editorial fixes, I mean, things like spellings. This isn't mainly a question of style. We are talking here not about constitutional writing style or fixing little mistakes, but we're talking about some important substance. We took that off the table. We're not going to do anything except editorial changes to the Bill of Rights. Nevertheless, people came in and wanted to be heard, and we listened to them. We had a committee on the Bill of Rights, and we took testimony, and people wanted to talk about that. And although we told them up front that you're going to leave that alone, you're not going to get into debates about those things, because we are concerned about how to accomplish the changes that will be, how shall I put it, policy neutral, that are not Democratic changes or Republican changes. They're not about who's winning and losing something here. They're talking about how we're going to improve the government. So that was the focus of that particular meeting, the commission. Now, I should tell you a little something that nobody else is going to lecture you about, but let me just mention it. There is a federal constitutional reason why laws don't belong in a constitution. And it was established by a decision of the Oregon Supreme Court in 1903, first time that the initiative, newly adopted initiative process was before the court. Now, the process was not any initiative. No, this was an Academy case. And I have a simple, readable for lay people reprint that. Did I give you one?
No.
Earlier, well, I'll leave this for you that you can make available to the members if they're interested. In essence, what the Cattley decision in Oregon in 1903 established was that the reason that direct legislation was compatible with the obligation, the federal obligation, to maintain a Republican form of government was that the legislature remained free to make laws. That we did have representative lawmaking in this state, and we would continue to have it, even if the people were able to initiate laws or refer laws. That was perfectly okay. You can get public consent for what you want to do. Or the people themselves can say, well, we'll initiate something, put in the laws, as long as the legislature remains free to change them. So what happened, you know, is that the court at that point had nothing before. There was no initiative before. Certainly they never mentioned constitutional amendments, because everybody in those days assumed constitutional amendments were about the way we govern ourselves and not substantive rules for private behavior. In 1912, when Washington adopted its constitution, it left amendments out. They cannot initiate constitutional amendments in the state of Washington. So all of the tax reduction initiatives that Tim Iman and other people put on the agenda there, and everything else, is in the form of statutes. You see, now that's the key difference. And so what we have now is a mess, a mixture of statutory and constitutional provisions, all under this heading called Constitution, but it's no longer just a Constitution. It's got a lot of things. And one section on the property tax, incidentally, I don't know if you ever look at it, in the code books, you've got these big code books, Oregon revised statutes, it takes 120 column inches, 10 feet of type. 120 column inches for that one provision. It's all one initiative. It wouldn't matter. It'd be just as bad if it were one, if the legislature submitted it as it just doesn't belong as a constitutional text. And there are many others like that. Okay, let me go on. So, what should you do? Here's what I would. The urge to legislate in the Constitution really counsels against seeking reform by first electing delegates to a convention. Most people are interested in substantive issues. They're going to want to bring those to the convention. They want to have provisions that refer to them, explain how this or that's going to work. And we avoided all that. The system in 1960 avoided those difficulties because we basically told people that's a legislative problem, we're not going to put it in the Constitution. Now, the way to get to where I think those of you who favor reform want to go is first to prepare a coherent document, a coherent constitution, and then let the legislature decide whether they want to adopt it or not, and then decide whether to call a convention after you have a document to look at, rather than saying, oh, let's have a convention and then see who comes up with a draft. I mean, or having an advisory commission isn't quite good enough. There are other ways, I should say, even in a draft, to submit genuinely divisive issues in which the public may have opposing views to your voters. You can do that simply by giving them choices. You can do that after you've prepared the document. You don't have to call a convention to do that. So here are my concrete suggestions. First, make this 150th anniversary the occasion for creating a new commission, similar to the one 50 years ago. It doesn't have to be identical. It should certainly include a substantial number of legislators, as that one did, other experienced former or present office holders or not, who can explain and can defend the commission's recommendations to the legislature, because that's where they go. They don't go directly to the voters. And then public members. But keep the number well below half of the total of the public commission on the legislature. Don't do that. Don't do something as big as the public commission on the legislature in which I served just 2006, 60 people. Second, do not limit what the commission may do, but direct it to start from the three versions of the draft that were approved of, they're reprinted. You can all read it, the whole report, everything was reprinted in the Oregon Law Review 25 years later in 1988. And then do what you want to do, adopt from those drafts or change them any way they want to. But look at those. The commission may well recommend quite different improvements from those that were made 50 years ago, but working backwards to revise the present text would be fatal. Not only because attention would focus on ideological disputes, but because a fair amount of mythology has grown up, has confused even what the institutional articles mean. Let me give you, I'm not talking about judicial disagreements, I mean mythology. Let me give you an example. The question that was raised by Attorney General Myers. He said, well, don't you want to have annual sessions? How many of you have heard or believe that you need a constitutional amendment to accomplish that today? It's a myth. Read the text. It doesn't say that. Nothing in the Constitution says it has to be that way. It can be debated. Legislative Council may give you that advice, but Legislative Council often will give you advice that turns out not to be conclusive. And then numbers. I've got them in a footnote here. The number of examples of issues that are debated in which people have certain strongly held beliefs. This is how it is, and usually it's because that's how we've done it. And so you can solve problems that way better. Now, third, direct the commission to report its proposal to the legislature in time for its 2011 session, and then plan to decide at that time whether to adopt a draft to send to the voters or to submit a draft to further review by an elected commission. You can do it then. You don't have to make that decision first. Get something in front of you to look at, and then to discuss whether it ought to be sent to a convention, whether the public wants a convention, whether they want to pay for a convention. It's an enormously expensive exercise, you know. It may not serve a very useful purpose except to satisfy the populist urge that's got to come from the people that Radovakian mentioned. Now, let me add one item that one can imagine a way to combine the desire for elected delegates with the value of a preparatory commission. And this would be, and I'm not proposing this, but that you can do it. This would be to include a number of such elected members, not 10 from each congressional district, but one or two elected members from each congressional district, to be there for that purpose, to say, well, this is what we think, that's what the folks back home, you know, will accept or not accept, or bring new ideas to the, you can have that. You can elect delegates. It's the only difficulty I want you to keep in mind. Two difficulties. One is it would do more harm than good if it enlarged the commission to much beyond 20 members. It becomes a different body. It cannot work the way we worked then, because you just don't get that interaction and that concentration. You begin splintering into work groups and committees and have a hard time. But the second let me leave it at that. If you have any questions, I'd be glad to answer them now or later. There may be things I've said that weren't clear.
Yes, Representative Greenlee.
Thank you, sir. The the proposal that was recommended, yes, by the last commission ultimately went to the people and was ultimately rejected 2-1, I think, roughly 63 or something. Is that right?
No, it didn't go to the people. What happened is very interesting. again, this is anecdotal, but it's important. One of the issues then, as it usually is, was over the apportionment provisions, the redistricting of legislative seats, you know, a matter of some interest to members of the legislature. And at that time, well, and the commission made a recommendation. They said, okay, we'll let every county be sure that it has one representative. And then the remaining representatives will be apportioned on the basis of population. That was a retrograde step, known to be that, because the Constitution had always said that the legislature would be apportioned on the basis of population only. But the only way we could get consensus on the whole document was to put this in about having one, at least one in each county. Counties are not really created for that purpose, but that's how it came out. And at that time, the Supreme Court of the United States had decided that it would indeed take up that issue. And previously had believed that it was non-justiciable, that the court would treat it as a political question. Well, no, they didn't. They said, we'll take it up. And then, that was 1962, and then they hadn't decided it yet. And so one of the Multnomah County Democrats, he said, one too many, most of them said, okay, we'll take our chances, we'll go ahead and send this out to the people the way it is, but they said, no, absolutely not. So we had the necessary two-thirds in the House, but fell one vote short in the Senate over an issue which within 12 months was resolved by the Supreme Court, and it would have been, vernacular term, it would have just been giving people a $3 bill to give them this assurance that they could have a representative in each county. There are ways to deal with those issues, by the way, and I don't want to go into substance today, but if you're trying to deal with the question about more representation, of course you can do it by other means that are totally consistent with the keeping districts proportionate to population. So we've learned a lot since 1963, but that's why it failed. Otherwise it would have gone to the voters.
Yes, Representative Thatcher.
Thank you. I just remember last session in the House Elections, Ethics, and Rules Committee, we had some pretty astounding testimony from, I think it was a high school group that came in and suggested removal of a certain provision from the Constitution. And we said, yeah, that makes sense, and it's going to be referred. What do you think about just taking these provisions one by one rather than, you know, as a whole?
You see, they're two quite different things. Now, I have to remind you, there are two conceptions of what a constitution really is for, and one is to think of it as a document. You know, so it's got all these provisions. Maybe some provisions might be moved out and so on. Yeah, you could do that. What happened? But that doesn't get to the root of the problem. The point of the Constitution is that it organizes the way we govern ourselves. A lot of these provisions that can be taken out, but if you say one by one, just walk through it backwards from the existing document. No, I mean, I said, and I mean it, that'd be fatal. You will not get a decent document on that basis. You can get rid of some of these excrescences that have kind of been attached to it over the last 100 years, and you can undo some spelling mistakes, and you can do other things. But the reason that the clean document that you could look at, if you want to read it, you can see what's in it. It's all available to you. That it was successful in the legislature, but for one except for needing two-thirds votes, was precisely that people could vote on the whole package and not have to vote on each individual provision. And I'm not sure which provisions you particularly have in mind. Do you have any in mind that you want to ask about? Or?
Thank you for asking me a question.
There's
obviously some concern among the people that are here and testifying that there are some things that need to be cleaned up.
Let me explain something. Again, I'm sorry. This isn't technical. It's just something people don't know about. You take, for example, the question, why is liquor by the drink in the Constitution? Everybody's ridiculed that provision for a long time. I don't know the answer. I wasn't there. I didn't do it. But I can guess for why. And that is that somebody may have said, but there's a provision over in the local government section of the Constitution that preserves local option, and that maybe we had better, if we want to do this, we'd better make sure that the system will work in the whole state, that it won't be subjected to a lot of controversy about that. I don't know whether that was the reason, but there are, after Article 11 is the original article that said that the state cannot incur a debt above $50,000. This keeps the state from going bankrupt by over promising and bond issues that the cat has no revenue source for. And this was a big deal in the 19th century. All the states adopted at that time had horrible experiences, and they said, we're going to put a debt limitation in. So what happened is, and they have now, you have Article 11A and B and C and D all the way through J or L or wherever, I'm not sure where we are now. And what you've done is, quite unnecessarily, to put every individual bond measure into the Constitution. That's why it looks the way it does. The document looks ridiculous. There's a simple way to do it, which we adopted in 1962, in that draft, that says no bond may be issued or no debt may be incurred over $50,000 except for the consent of the voters. Then you've done it once and for all. You see what I mean? So this is a lot of the things people are pointing to and saying, well, this can come out and that can come out. You know, this is superseded. Well, sure. But you haven't accomplished anything when you do that. As a matter of fact, after this measure failed, the 1963 measure failed to make it on the ballot because that one vote, the legislature submitted a mere cleanup to the voters. I don't remember when this was, but some 6 years later or whatever. And they voted it down. There's nothing to doing it. There's no momentum behind it. Nobody argued for it. There wasn't any campaign. It was just a cleanup. And so it failed. If you have to build a support for modernizing the government. The thing is that, as I said, this isn't a hearing for this purpose. I understand that, and I don't want to go into it. But the kind of things that the other witnesses have mentioned to you are the important things. The question, for example, about the post-audit function sounds dull. But not only this commission back then, but the Public Commission, 2006, recommended that we create a model somewhat like the Comptroller General of the United States, a J.O. type model, to do the investigatory things and the other things under nonpartisan leadership, where it's absolutely clear that the person who ran that thing was not eligible to run for another statewide office. This was not a political stepping stone office. You may get some criticism about why do we want to do away with all people love to elect their elected officials. Fine. No problem. that's what people, what the legislature thinks, you're going to keep them all. But what is not sound is to have the elections division and the audit division headed by somebody who historically, back when I was on the commission 50 years ago, was the number one stepping stone and the next in line to the governorship, and could be, and sometimes was, elected from the opposite party of the sitting governor. I mean, that's just nonsense. That's not an intelligent way to organize a government. You can do those things piecemeal if you want to, but by having it a coherent body, it takes a lot of the controversy out of it. We never would have come so close as to 2/3 of the vote if people hadn't seen more good in the document as a whole than they disliked about a particular provision.
Representative Richardson, did you have anything?
No, actually, I'm finding it really difficult to hear over the phone the testimony. I've been struggling. I'm only catching part of it. So.
Okay, well, then Representative Greenlick.
Yes, thank you, sir. Hi, let me try again with my question, and perhaps we should wait for Mr. Hinkle to talk. But from a memo he's done in 2002, he said, debate over the Commission's proposal continued during the next three legislative sessions. Several significant changes were made to the 1962 draft, and a considerably modified version was submitted to the voters by the 69 legislature. It was rejected.
Yeah.
6436. I think you just characterized that as a sort of housekeeping cleanup. Is that basically what it was?
I could not today. I mean, I was following these things, and I was deeply involved in the earlier one. I could not today dredge up from memory what was even in that document. I had no interest in it. I wasn't paying, putting any effort into it. At the time of the 1962, when we finished our work, I wrote a series of newspaper, short newspaper articles that explained the draft, and went about 7 or 8 of the regional papers throughout the state. And there was a good deal of public discussion of, is this the direction we want to go in? But no, I don't remember that. I think that I've read Mr. Hinckley's article before in 2002 and again now. And yeah, you can always say, well, what's wrong with it? We're doing it beautifully. This government is running marvelously, and why don't we just continue working the way it is? You people are in a much better position to test whether you think the system can be improved, than somebody on the outside. But I'll tell you that I see a lot of problems about, and somebody mentioned the judicial branch, for example. Yes, if anybody today were drafting a judicial article, this is not the article they would draft. You know, this is not the way we would go about and get judges. Do you know that as late as 19, I think it was 23 or something like that, maybe later, maybe 30, judges were elected on partisan tickets in the state? You ran as a Republican, and you ran against the opponents of Democrats. Today, for most of us, that would seem very odd and unprincipled way to do it, you know. But there are still states today. Just New York system just went to the U.S. Supreme Court just 6 months ago. They had a decision about it. Wisconsin has had, Minnesota had the case about whether judges had to be, if they're going to be elected, if they have to go out and campaign, are entitled to go out and have free speech about what platform they're running on. I mean, come on. Yeah. We don't have that experience here most of the time. But as a system, nobody would do that today.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Well, I'm not seeing any other questions. And
all right.
I really appreciate you being here. It's been very educational. And
thank you.
I'm
serious. If you have questions in the future as you work on this, if you're going to go forward on this, I'm across the street, and I'm glad to answer any questions.
Thank you very much.
Sure.
With that, I'm going to... I'm going to call Brenda Bays, Deputy Director of the Elections Division of the Secretary of State's office. So whenever you're ready.
Thank you. Chair Riley, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Brenda Bays. I'm the Deputy Director for the State Elections Division. I have been asked to attend the hearing today to discuss your proposal for Senate Bill 920. Our office sees three elections in which the election costs would increase for the state and counties: the primary election, the general election, and a statewide special election, to which the electors would vote on the drafted constitution. The primary and general election ballot would increase in size by adding these candidates for each congressional district. Because it is unknown how many candidates would file for these offices, we cannot determine an exact impact on those elections. For example, if you had 20 candidates file for each congressional district, that's 100 candidates additional for that election. Because of the increase in candidates on these primary and general election ballots, this would increase the size of the ballots for the counties. It's one-page ballot versus a two-page ballot. With that increase, the cost of printing and mailing those ballots would increase. The bill also provides that the drafted constitution would be submitted to the people in an odd number year. We just had November 2007 special election, and that cost for the state was approximately $1.7 million. Those are our concerns. If you have any questions you'd like to address to us, I'm more than happy to answer those for you.
Apparently not. Thank you very much for your testimony.
You're welcome.
So I'm going to call Charlie Hinkle, and thank you very much for being with us today. It's always a pleasure to have you address us, and I'd love to hear what you have to say.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Charles Hinkle. I'm a lawyer in private practice in Portland, and I have spent a good part of my time in private practice over the last 37 years in dealing with constitutional law issues. I taught constitutional law for several years at Lewis and Clark Law School and been chairman of the Oregon State Bar Constitutional Committee, and have spoken many times on these subjects. I don't think anyone would disagree with the proposition that the Oregon Constitution is messy and contains a lot of provisions in there that should be somewhere else. And I also would affirm the proposition, although no, I don't think anyone has said it in so many terms this morning, but it would be a lot of fun to try to draft a new constitution. But I also think that it would be a very expensive proposition and at the end of the day would be futile. You have copies of this article that I wrote back in 2002. There was some public comment at that time about why we needed a new constitution, and I responded to it with an Oregonian op-ed piece, and this memo that you have in front of you is more or less a version of that op-ed piece. And as I say in the memo, there are three principal areas of concern that proponents of a new constitution have focused on. The first being a new form of government, and as you see in top of page two of the memo, that 1961 commission voted by a vote of 9-6 to reform the entire structure of government, the executive branch at least, so that there'd be only one elected statewide official. I mention that vote because that illustrates the kind of contention and the kind of narrow division that would inevitably occur in any body that drafts a new constitution, whether it be a constitutional commission or a constitutional convention. And I certainly agree with the speakers who have said this morning that a constitutional convention, which Commissioner Avakian is a proponent of, would be a zoo. It would be, you know, the 1857 convention lasted, I think, maybe 6 weeks. Can you imagine 60 delegates or 100 delegates or something in Oregon today debating these things and getting their work done in 6 weeks? It wouldn't happen. It would go on at great length. It may be that having a form of government with a single, having the governor as the only single elect statewide official would be a great way to run the government. But the proponents of a new of that or of any other new structure haven't pointed to a single error, a single mistake, a single defect that has actually occurred in our Oregon form of government over these last 150 years that has resulted from the existing structure of the executive branch. So we could reshuffle the chairs and create new offices and abolish old ones. You know, there are 50 states and there are probably 50 different structures of an executive branch. But unless someone can persuade you that the form of the executive branch in Alaska or North Carolina or Vermont is vastly superior to the form that we have here in Oregon, my question is, why bother? I mean, what would we be accomplishing by shifting the chairs around? I submit to you, not very much. The second major area of concern is modification of the Bill of Rights. Now, Justice Lindy said this morning that the 1961-62 Commission did not modify, or at least it was their intent not to modify the original 1857 Bill of Rights, but in fact their product did modify it, particularly the Free Speech Clause, in a very dramatic way. Now, maybe it wasn't their intent, but they did it, and if it was not their intent, that in itself demonstrates how even a minor change could have a big effect, perhaps inadvertent. The change was this. The existing Constitution from 1857 says no law shall be passed restricting freedom of speech and so forth. What the new Constitution, the proposed new Constitution in 62 said was free speech shall not be restrained. In other words, it was not aimed at the government. The original Constitution says no law shall be passed. It's a restriction on government. The proposed new Constitution was not a restriction on government. It was a restriction on everybody. And the best evidence of that is that the California Supreme Court has construed their similar provision in the California Constitution, that is, a provision that does not speak to the government. It doesn't say no law shall be passed. The California Constitution, like the proposed new Oregon Constitution, said something like the right of free expression shall not be restrained. The California Supreme Court says that right runs against the world. It doesn't run against the government. It runs against the world so that you can invoke the free speech clause of the California Constitution against your neighbor, against your landlord, against the homeowners association, against the local Safeway store, according to the California Supreme Court. Now, maybe that was not the intent of the 62 Oregon Commission, but to change the language even by deleting two words, no law, four words, no law shall be passed, five words, no law, even deleting something as simple as that can have a very dramatic, far-reaching, and perhaps unintentional change. Now, as it stands today, where are we? 50 years after that, almost 50 years after that proposed 1960 revision, the Oregon Free Speech Clause has been construed in very, again, dramatic fashion, I guess we could say. In 1960, the state of the law, the state of constitutional interpretation in Oregon under the Free Speech Clause, was unexceptional. It had more or less followed the U.S. Supreme Court in lockstep. Whatever the U.S. Supreme Court said about the federal Free Speech Clause, we'll go along with that in terms of our Oregon Free Speech Clause. But in the last 30 years, largely as a result of Justice Lindy's marvelous and universally respected work in this area, the Oregon Free Speech Clause has taken on a life of its own. And so, as I'm sure you all are well aware, there are at least three examples where the Oregon Free Speech Clause differs dramatically from the Federal Free Speech Clause, and that is in the area of obscenity, commercial speech, and campaign finance contributions and expenditures. All of those are absolutely protected under the Oregon Constitution. None of them are absolutely protected under the federal Constitution. So if we had adopted a new constitution in 1960 as proposed by that commission, we would have presumably adopted it with the understanding of the free speech interpretation that was then in effect, which means that our constitution today, our state constitution, would be as limited in those areas of protection of obscenity, commercial speech, and campaign finance, as limited as the federal constitution is. Now, you may think that's a great idea. I'm not debating the pros and cons of that. I'm just saying our constitution, our free speech clause, would be dramatically different today in Oregon if the 1960 constitution, as proposed by that commission, had been adopted. The Equal Privileges and Immunities Clause is another vivid example. In that instance, I believe the 1960 Commission did adopt verbatim the existing 1857 clause, but consider the interpretation that was given as of 1960 of that clause. Women were not protected by Oregon's Equal Privileges and Immunities Clause as of 1960. There were two prevailing Oregon Supreme Court cases that interpreted the Equal Privilege and Immunities Clause of the Oregon Constitution as of 1960, and both of those said women don't count. One of them was one of them sustained a law that said that barred women from going into saloons, and the other one, a much more recent decision, a post-World War II decision, the Oregon Supreme Court said that Equal Privileges and Immunities Clause did not prevent the legislature from prohibiting women from engaging in professional wrestling. Now, you may think that's a good idea or a bad idea, but the point is the Constitution was not construed, the Oregon Constitution was not construed as of 1960 to protect women. At least not, you know, there's no strict scrutiny. There was no close application of the Equal Privileges and Immunities Clause. So, again, if the 1960 Constitution had been adopted by the people, against that background, on the basis of that background of those two Oregon Supreme Court decisions, the constitutional law of Oregon today would be that women are not fully protected by the Equal Privileges and Immunities Clause. It was only because the Oregon Supreme Court in about 1983 decided, ignoring really the intent of the framers, that the 1857 clause on its face, its very language, did in fact protect women. It is because of that judicial interpretation of the 1857 clause that the court changed its mind and said, yes, now women are fully protected by that clause. But they wouldn't have been if the 1960 revision had been adopted. Now, the third area of concern, the third reason for a new constitution, we're told, is to clean up the mess. There's so much in the Constitution that doesn't belong there. I would venture to say that 98% of what they're talking about is the result of one thing, and one thing only, and that is the initiative and referendum clause. All of the non-constitutional things, all of the things that should be in statute, nearly all of them, the ones that are controversial at any rate, have been put in by way of initiative petition. And the reason they are put in the Constitution by way of initiative petition is precisely because the proponents of those measures want it in the Constitution so that the legislature cannot tinker with it. So if we were now, in 2008, to propose a new Constitution that did not have the property tax limitation in it, do you think Bill Sizemore and Don McIntyre would say, oh yeah, let's vote for that? Do you think that if a new constitution did not have the crime initiatives, including the prison worker section that was mentioned this morning, do you think Kevin Mannix would be out campaigning for a new constitution that did not include all of the criminal measures that he has promoted and successfully placed in the Constitution over the years? Of course not. So the debate in any constitutional convention or in any constitutional commission would be, shall we include these measures that Oregon voters have shown they want in the Constitution, or should we present to them a new document that does not include them? And we're not talking about ancient history, after all. We're talking about things that Oregon voters have put in the Constitution in the last 25 years. And yes, they're messy. Yes, they are ambiguous. Yes, from any good government point of view, they don't belong there. But I submit to you that it would be a fool's errand to present something to the voters of this state that did not include them. And consider the other things, many other things that are in the Constitution. You've heard some of them mentioned this morning. The death penalty. If you are a strong proponent of the death penalty, would you vote for a constitution that did not have it in there? We voted, the people have voted, what, three or four times now on a constitutional amendment regarding the death penalty. Sometimes Oregonians have put it in the Constitution. Once they took it out, then they put it back in again. Oregonians now want it in the Constitution. Do you think there's a ghost of a chance that a constitution would pass if it did not have the death penalty in it? What about that same-sex marriage? Or the proposal we just adopted 2 years ago, marriage shall be a union of one man and one woman. Would a new constitution pass with that or without it? You know, the abortion rights. Should there be a due process clause? You know, that was one of the strongest points of debate back in 1916. Justice Lindy was strongly opposed to it. He, on that occasion, was on the losing side of the vote, and the majority of the commission wanted the due process clause in there. Would the due process clause in the Oregon Constitution be a roving commission, as some have called it, in the federal Constitution, for a court to strike down laws that it doesn't like on the grounds that they violate so-called substantive due process? That's how we got the Roe v. Wade. I mean, whether you like Roe v. Wade or you dislike Roe v. Wade, that is a substantive due process case. The homosexual sodomy case is a substantive due process case. Going back much further, the law, the court decision that struck down the Oregon statute that prohibited private schools, that required everybody, every student in the state, to go to public schools, and so it obviously had the effect of prohibiting, illegalizing Roman Catholic parochial schools. That was struck down on the basis of substantive due process. Do you want to give courts that power? That was one of the main points of debate in 1960, and it is a debate that would be a very interesting one. I would love to participate in it. I think it would be great fun. But, you know, there are people who feel strongly that it should not be in there. The mess is the product of the initiative system. And that's why I asked your staff this morning to distribute Initiative Petition 102, just as an example. This is a petition for the current session. We don't know yet if it's going to go on the ballot. They haven't turned in signatures yet, and I don't know. But look at it. The point is, it's 2 pages long, hundreds and hundreds of words. There are only 2 operative sentences, the first 2 sentences, Section 1, Section 2. They say, in essence, that initiative measures shall control campaign expenditures. But then look at the rest of it. All of that would go in the Constitution if IP 102 is passed. And so our Constitution would say, for example, on page 2, Enron Corporation took over PGE in 1997. That would be in the Oregon Constitution. Why? Because the proponents of this measure want it there. I think that's a mistake, and I've asked the courts to not to allow 102 to go on the ballot if it gets enough signatures. But this is just one of hundreds of examples that you're all familiar with of proponents of the initiative wanting to put in the Constitution measures that will be safe from tinkering by the legislature, beyond the reach of legislative modification. It's messy, but the Constitution reflects the will of the people, for better or for worse. And our Constitution in 2008 does reflect the will of the people, and streamline it or not, I think it would be a waste of taxpayer money to go down this road. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Hinkle. Any questions?
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Representative Greenlee.
Thank you, sir. Thank you for your courtesies to me today. I appreciate that. This is an area that's important to me. The concept of the will of the people is a slippery one as well, isn't it? I mean, in a sense, the people 25 years ago might have felt strongly about one particular item, and then, well, in fact, the death penalty is the perfect example, as you mentioned it. They felt strongly in, strongly out, strongly in. Is there a sense that the will of the people might be expressed differently viewing an omnibus proposal? I think that's the sort of concept than individual items within that.
Well, our best evidence of that is what happened in 1970 when the voters turned down a new constitution. It was a draft that was based on the 1960 draft. It had some substantial changes to it, but it was still based on that 1960 revision. It wasn't a revision of the original constitution. It was a revision of the 1960 proposal. And when the voters turn something back down by a 2-1 vote, that's not a good omen that they're ready to rethink fundamentally their constitutional system. If it ain't broke, don't fix it. Again, going to the liquor laws or these tax laws or something, you can transfer them from this page of the law books to this page of the law books, but aside from the fact that that's aesthetically pleasing, what difference does it make?
Could you just sort of talk a little bit about that campaign in 1970? I don't remember at all. So.
You know, it's been a while since I looked at the measure that was on the ballot. I did so in 2002 when I wrote that article, and I didn't have a chance to do it in preparation for today's hearing. You know, the law says that the full text of any measure is supposed to be printed in the voter's pamphlet, so I presume that we can go back to the 1970 voter's pamphlet and find the text of that, or in the Oregon law, or in the session laws from that year, because it, presumably it was a referral from the legislature, so it must be there in the session laws of the 1969 legislature, I guess. And you could see for yourselves how close it is to the 1960 proposal, which you do have before you. It's reprinted there in the Oregon Law Review sections that were reproduced for you. I wasn't in the state in May of 1970 when it went to the ballot, so I can't tell you what the debate was about.
Thank you.
Anything else? Seeing none, thank you very much.
Thank
Mr. Hinkle, I appreciate your testimony. And that leaves us with Mr. Westwood.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, I'm Jim Westwood. I am, coincidentally, a partner of Charlie Hinkle in the same law firm. We both practice constitutional law and have for some time. Seeing Representative Greenlick here, I'd like to mention also that I'm one of the coaches of the U.S. Grant High School Constitution team.
Yay.
Along with Representative Greenlick's son, who's also a coach of that team, and I coached his granddaughters. It's been a wonderful experience. It's made me a much better lawyer, and it's helped me become a better student of the history of not just the federal Constitution, but the Oregon Constitution as well. And I'd like to come at it from that standpoint. I'm essentially an historian. The Oregon Constitution, everybody here has agreed, is today pretty much a mess. I would agree with my friend and colleague, Mr. Hinkle, that the initiative process is largely responsible for that. But how did we get there? We have an amendment process now which allows in a single election cycle either the legislature to refer a constitutional amendment or the people through the initiative to place it on the ballot and have it approved. Simple majority, all it takes to get the amendment passed. It wasn't always that way. The original Oregon Constitution provided, much as the federal Constitution does, a buffer, a filter, a make-it-hard sort of process under which the Oregon legislature would recommend a constitutional amendment, and it would lie fallow for 2 years until the next legislative session would be required to pass that same amendment once again. Then it would go to the people for their approval. It wasn't easy. In fact, it was done only once in the history of the state of Oregon, and that was to bring about the initiative and referendum. In 1900 and 1902, the people voted, the legislature in 1901 and 1903 sessions voted, and the people approved the initiative and referendum, which then became, by 1906, the only method we had, either referral by the legislature on a simple majority vote or initiative amendment. We no longer have that safety valve, and as a result, the initiative has become the method of choice for amending the Oregon Constitution, and we see what we have. This is a product, I think, of the early progressive era, when before the United States Supreme Court had started talking about due process, equal protection jurisprudence, and at a time when direct democracy was seen as something really good, beware, however, unintended consequences, there was very little regard for the federal constitution at that time and practically no regard for state constitutions. So I think times have changed quite a bit. There's been a lot of constitutional scholarship, federal constitutional scholarship in the last 20 years. We've had Justice Lindy becoming an expounder of the Oregon Constitution as something separate. Oregon constitutional jurisprudence is a wonderful thing now, a very rich body, probably the richest in the country. I think maybe one first step before I get to the idea of a constitutional convention or commission, a modest proposal for the legislature, if we don't go down that difficult road of a commission or a convention, is the possibility of amending the Constitution, maybe through initiative, to eliminate constitutional amendments by initiative. You know, it's not easy, but maybe that's easier even than going through a commission or a convention. And also perhaps requiring at the same time a supermajority of the legislature to refer a constitutional amendment, maybe going back to our original two separate sessions notion. Those are just thoughts. But now let me get to the more substantive procedural aspect of this. How do we go about, if we want to clean up the mess under the existing Article 17 of the Oregon Constitution, how do we do it? Do we do it under Section 1, a convention, Section 2, a commission, or, as my friend Mr. Hinkle has said, throw up your hands, let's not do either of them. I agree it's going to be very difficult politically to get any kind of a constitutional revision accomplished in Oregon. I don't think it's impossible, or certainly, as a good existentialist, I think perhaps the effort should be made. We should miss that bus running to show that we're really trying to do something. Should we have a commission, as Justice Lindy has proposed? I think not, and here another historical reason why. In 1776, right after the Continental Congress had adopted the Declaration of Independence, Congress sent a circular to the states urging them to adopt their own constitutions now that they were newly independent. Several states did. Massachusetts did in 1776. By 1780, the revolution's still going on, but there were some very wise people who realized, wait, this constitution that our legislature has given us isn't really legitimate. And so, no less a person than John Adams he pushed it hard, and it went through, and in 1780, Massachusetts had a constitutional convention in the midst of the Revolutionary War, and they adopted what is now the Massachusetts Constitution. Other states followed suit, and in 1787, so did the federal government. Well, the Confederation government. Could you imagine what would have happened in 1787 if the Confederation Congress had appointed a commission to draft a constitution to present to the people? I don't think it would have worked. Instead, we had a constitutional convention with people like James Wilson and James Madison and John Adams and George Washington and Alexander Hamilton attending the constitutional convention and drafting a constitution. I think in Oregon, we ought to have a constitutional convention, not a commission. And it needs to be done carefully, and we need to get a groundswell of public support to the extent we can going, so that the delegates to this constitutional convention are not inhabitants of a zoo, as Mr. Hinkle said, but are rather the best and the brightest, the people who would be on a commission perhaps, but popularly elected, giving legitimacy to the convention. I am thinking of people like Hans Lindy, like Charlie Hinkle, like Dave Frohnmeyer, Betty Roberts, Norma Paulus, people of great stature in this state, putting themselves forward, much as George Washington did, finally, for election to the Constitutional Convention to make that convention what it really needs to be, a civics lesson for the people of Oregon, to elevate the debate, to raise the consciousness of the people of Oregon to what a constitution is about, much as we coaches of the Grant Constitution team do for our students. It changes their lives. I think we can change the political life of Oregon with a properly prepared and executed constitutional convention to present to the people of Oregon a thoroughly thought out constitution that they can then either adopt or reject. But having gone through this process, I think the people of Oregon would be much the better for it. That's the extent of my testimony. I'm open for questions.
Well, don't get up. I actually have a couple of questions. That was a very spirited testimony. Maybe the most spirited testimony we've heard today. And you make it sound very inviting. And one of the things you said, however, was you talked about the people that should or might likely choose to run for election for this convention. If those are the folks we want, why don't we appoint them? What's the difference? Tell me why that.
You're wondering why not a commission?
Basically, yes.
Again, it goes back to the lesson of history. From the fact that legislatures were drafting constitutions for the states before 1780 when Massachusetts changed the paradigm, and the fact that even though this would be a commission, it would be a legislatively created commission, one branch of government, taking the rap, if you will, for the Constitution. I believe Commissioner Avakian said that this ought to be something that's done by the people, and I would agree with that. I think rather than have a legislatively created commission to propose a constitution, it is much more legitimate and at the end of the day, I think more productive to have a convention that's popularly elected rather than appointed.
Can I follow on that?
Absolutely.
The bill that we proposed has essentially both a commission and a convention. And in that bill, the way it's written, the commission is an advisory group to the convention so that it can comment on and make recommendations. What would you think about a model that had a commission that proposed and a convention that disposed of those kinds of issues, some closer link between the commission we propose and the convention?
It probably is much more realistic, frankly, to think of something like that. But again, I go back to the source of legitimacy for a constitution, which is, I believe, not simply a convention even deliberating on, but ultimately perhaps rubber stamping, but rather getting down and dirty and doing the work. I would welcome Don McIntyre at a constitutional convention. I would love to be there myself, debating him on some of these issues and letting the people see what's happening. This civics lesson, if you will. It seems to me, although the federal constitutional convention was done entirely in private, that we're beyond that now. I think it would have to be a public convention.
We don't do things like that.
No, and it would probably be very messy. To the extent that it was not a zoo, a circus, to the extent that the discourse was at a high level, and that people around the state were tuning in to watch this, and were reading the newspapers, and were getting excited about it, we would have such a better government and such a better fundamental document coming out of it. So to answer your question, Representative Greenlee, I would tend more to favor perhaps an advisory commission that the convention would be more likely than not to disregard in most respects, and not to have something where you have the members of the convention being automatons. We'd want thinkers, people who really could create something at this convention, and it might not work that way, and I'd be distressed if it didn't. But again, it I think is worth the try, because anything else, I think, short sells the people of Oregon in how we're creating our fundamental document.
Thank you very much for your testimony.
Thank you for the invitation.
Mr. Chairman, I comment as he leaves. Mr. Westwood did mention the grand constitution theme, and through watching my son involved in this and my two granddaughters whose teams finished second and third in the country, incidentally, it just strikes me the enormous debt of gratitude we have to people like Mr. Westwood, the Constitution coaches, and coaches in high schools throughout the state. We struggle with the extent to which we should put civics into the required curriculum of the high schools in our education committee. But the main place that's expressed, and it is through these folks who are mostly volunteers, mostly not paid teachers, although the paid teachers are involved as well, in really helping our kids around the state think about the issues of civic life. And we owe, I think, an important debt of gratitude to Mr. Westwood and his colleagues throughout the state.
Yes, Representative Richardson.
Having listened closely, especially to the last two presenters, it's very interesting. Mr. Westwood essentially, I think, is saying, you know, you mentioned about John Adams and the work with Massachusetts Constitutional Convention, and my recollection of history was that the federal constitution was actually a result of constitutional conventions that were originally designed to deal with the weaknesses of the Articles of Confederation and were not organized to essentially change the whole form of the government and write a constitution. That happened, but it wasn't the original intention. I think that necessity is the mother of convention. And in both instances, there was a necessity that a sense of crisis that forced a change over the top of individuals who may have been very resistant to it. Even our Revolutionary War, if there was a census of who was supported and who wasn't, my understanding of history is that at the outset of the Revolutionary War, there were more territories than there were revolutionaries. But, you know, we're grateful with the country we have, and now we're discussing in Oregon possibly having a rewrite of the Constitution, and I personally would think that there is not the necessity, the sense of crisis that would enable the coalitions to be built, the consensus to be reached, that would allow even the initial beginning of such a convention. I mean, I myself would be very concerned about who would be invited to be there of those that were named as possible people of the level of maturity and understanding to be at that convention. I don't know how many of them would be strong supporters of gun ownership and rights which are presently contained and protected in our Constitution. I think that Mr. Hinkle's comments that this would be fun, expensive, and futile is probably accurate, because there, at the end of this process, there will be something for everyone to hate. And it's much harder to get reform through than it is to stop reform. And so this is an interesting hearing today. I'm not sure that we're going to get any closer to actually having a rewrite of the Constitution, because of the concern that many, many people have over those parts of the Constitution which may well be changed to their disliking.
Thank you for that. Anyone else on the... There's no other comments, and we have no one signed up. If there's anyone who would like to say a few words, we have about 10 minutes. Seeing none, I'm going to close the committee. Thank you very much.